conservative host, conservative host, does whatever a conservative host does. Can he swing from a web? No, he can't. He's a conservative host. Look out. Look out for Jimmy Sangenberger. Look out for Jimmy Sangenberger. Oh, you good DJ.
You're listening to Sang Center with Jimmy Sangenberger here on KRCX 93.9.
Welcome back to Sang Center here on KRCX 93.9, The Real Deal. Jimmy Sangenberger back with you. Unfortunately, we had some technical issues with our phone system, and we had to let Matt Arnold go. However, never fear, next week he will be joining us as a member of a panel of several individuals who are, and this is the announcement he was going to talk about tonight, who have declared their candidacy for the chairman for the Colorado Republican Party. Matt Arnold is in the ring, along with a number of other candidates in this race, including Leandre Golston, who will also be here next week for this forum we're putting together. He is the current vice chairman for the state party. Then also State Senator Ted Harvey and Ryan Call, former chairman of the Denver Republican Party. They've also been extended invitations. Not sure who else will be coming on for next week, but Matt Arnold will be among the guests, as well as Leandre Golston. All those guys are in this increasingly crowded field to become the next chairman for the Colorado Republican Party, so we're looking forward to next week's conversation. Instead of having Matt on to actually talk about his decision himself, I want to read a little bit from his press release tonight. He wrote, "Insanity has been defined as doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. For too long, the Colorado Republicans have been doing the same thing over and over, and we've been losing. This is why I am now announcing my candidacy for state Republican Party chairman. There is a clear choice in this race: experienced and committed grassroots leadership based on proven commitment to principle and innovative thinking instead of more of the same. We absolutely must capture the energy and commitment to principle that characterized the great grassroots uprising of the past 2 years, and I am just the candidate to do that. There are some other great candidates in this race, but I will and do bring a whole other skill set to the table, one that will breathe new life in the party and show we truly aren't insane." And then he goes on to give his message for the Colorado Republican Party. You can check out his Facebook page, Matt Arnold for Colorado GOP State Chair, if you're interested in getting more info on that. And, of course, he, along with at least one other candidate, Leandre Golston, hopefully some of the others, will be here on Sang Center for an online college radio forum with the candidates. So we're looking forward to that. It should be quite a race up ahead. But now I'm pleased to welcome into the studio here State Representative for House District Number 22 in Colorado. Ken Summers is with us. Representative Summers, welcome to Sang Center.
Hey, good evening. It's great to be here.
Good to have you here, sir. So I know you had some committee meetings and whatnot today. How are things going over there in the legislature?
You know, we are making progress. We've just come to the point of some deadlines of some bills this week, and so we're trying to get some bills cleared out of the House side, and we're just about getting to the halfway point in the legislative session, and so things are moving along.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you are on the Health and Environment Committee, and there was an interesting piece of legislation that was, I think went down today in the committee that dealt with electronic waste. What was that about? That's interesting.
Yeah, I'm the chairman of the House Health and Environment Committee. Mm-hmm. And we had an interesting bill because we realized that we have to be responsible in terms of environmental issues. And there's a bill that Representative Randy Fisher from Fort Collins is working on, an issue that's, you know, of importance to him around the recycling of electronic waste. And he had crafted a bill this year that had a proposal to deal with electronic waste. The stakeholders that were involved in the process couldn't come to agreement, and so he ended up killing his own bill. What is interesting about the bill, though, is as important as recycling is and recycling of various materials, when it comes to electronic waste, it's a little bit more problematic. And what was the crux of this bill that is interesting from a policy standpoint is it would have actually required some responsibility on the part of electronic manufacturers. And so whether it was HP, Dell Computer, Sony, various manufacturers of electronics basically would have been responsible for ensuring that a percentage of what they sold was recycled. And so that becomes the real challenge. Is a manufacturer of a product responsible for the product after it changes ownership?
How can you enforce something like that?
Well, and that was part of the issue because there were some enforcement mechanisms in place where they would be required to pay some fees up front or they'd be required to recycle a certain percentage of what they sold, and so that it was up to them then to offer either rebates to get it back, and it became very problematic. The enforcement issue was certainly huge relative to that type of an approach, and I feel it's much more prudent at this point to educate consumers about the need to recycle effectively and where that can take place, and to take that sort of approach now until the technology improves in a way where really recyclers can actually make a profit in just recycling electronic waste, like businesses can recycle plastics and newspaper and other kinds of recyclables.
Right. Yeah, that's an interesting type of proposal where you actually put the onus on private industry, which seems to be more and more a direction that government is going, is let's mandate that private companies do things along these sorts of lines that they think are socially or environmentally responsible as mandated by the government.
Yeah, it becomes very problematic because it does then place responsibility to say, well, you're the manufacturer of this product and you're creating new products, technology is improving, and we have this kind of built-in obsolescence, so the product life cycle is shortened dramatically. So because you're the one who is generating and producing and manufacturing these items, you have responsibility, not only to inform and to encourage and to facilitate, but actually a financial and legal responsibility to control that product once it leaves your hand. And that's very problematic.
Yeah. I mean, when I go to the store and I buy like this Toshiba laptop I have here, a printer, that's my responsibility. So your idea or your thesis is that what we should have, if anything, the government do in this regard is just education efforts to let the public know what they can do to responsibly dispose of this electronic waste.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for example, now, we've all seen for cell phones, for example, and sometimes we'll see little containers at stores or wherever. Sometimes even nonprofits will do a cell phone recycling where they'll take old cell phones and maybe have them rebuilt, refurbished them, send them, reuse them in some way, whether it's for nonprofit areas or outside the country, where the case may be. And but also I have a old laptop that I said, if I don't know what to do with it, I don't want to, I don't want to just throw it in the trash. I need to, and so I think there is an issue where the public often says, well, what do I do with my old TVs? What do I do with my, old computers that aren't working anymore? How do I dispose of those in a prudent and responsible fashion? And I think we need to begin there to see what kind of actions we can stimulate in terms of addressing, the issue of recycling these items in a conscientious and environmentally safe fashion.
Yeah, that's certainly going to be a lot more effective than a convoluted way of mandating private industry to do something like this or taking other steps of government oversight and making sure that certain things are done that can present difficulties. Now, on the subject of environment, since you are chair of the Health and Environment Committee in the House, our guest, State Representative Ken Summers, one of the issues that I know a lot of college students, excluding myself, care about, and that is this supposed threat of global warming or global climate change. First off, what's your take on this? Do you see it as a man-made or man-caused threat to the country?
I've done a degree of reading and research on the issue, and even in talking with some older and more conservative individuals, they may even say man-made production, man-made influence on the environment may be a factor.
Right.
But when you look at the broader scope of, you know, of issues of just natural climate change cycles, you know, we realize that it's not just 100% man-made. And then part of the challenge becomes we don't even know then if part of the changes in climate are impacted by human activity, what percentage of that is that really taking place? And then what does it mean to even, you know, impact that? I mean, I think I had brought this up to individuals who are into the environmental issues, and they've basically agreed that if we had zero contribution to the carbon footprint, if we were to actually eliminate our carbon footprint in the United States, that it would be mitigated in a matter of weeks because
of China and India.
Yeah, because of the rest of the world and the activities of the rest of the world. And so it's an issue that is, I think, it's very, you know, problematic, and we need to understand the causes of it and to be open-minded in terms of really the impact of these cycles, what drives them. We see that I think there's as much evidence that there's some natural cycles the Earth just goes through, oftentimes, you know, more maybe impacted by the sun and sunspots and things of that nature than human activity.
Right. No, I absolutely agree with you. I mean, there are – it's something – if you have something so complex as climate – And you're predicting something like climate out well into the future, decades into the future, I think it's misguided to pin it on one single thing. But of course, a lot of politicians in this day and age, particularly on the Democratic Party, but also some Republicans, are advocating strict regulations and restrictions such as cap and trade and other proposals to deal with this supposed problem, this supposed climate crisis. Or have there been anything in this legislative session so far that's come out specifically trying to address this supposed climate crisis?
You know, I haven't seen anything at this point. There may be something out there. I haven't seen anything from the House side, you know, so I don't know if there's anything on the Senate side that has, you know, is purported to relate it to this. One thing that does come to mind that's kind of interesting is the House just passed a bill. We anticipate it'll probably get killed in the Senate. Dealing with, for example, let's look at ozone and the issues. We have this emissions testing program that takes place with automobiles. Mm-hmm. And in recent years, matter of fact, Weld and Larimer County up north was just included in the zone that the containment zone is referred to that EPA uses to monitor, you know, ozone levels. And we actually, you know, passed a bill that basically exempted them out, but it allowed flexibility for local communities to have auto testing and admissions testing if they wanted to. One thing that I found was interesting, one of the testimonies of on the scientific side, you know, right now it's like 70 parts per million of ozone is kind of what sensors monitor and is the standard right now. The federal EPA is looking at changing that to 65 or 60. And if I remember right, somebody testified that if there were no cars whatsoever, ozone precursors would be like at 55. And so, you know, when there's even a problem with science relative to, you know, what is even a baseline of ozone through natural sources? And especially when it comes to automotive emissions, I remember a few years ago in talking to the Department of Health, and because I had constituents bring up to me saying, Ken, you know, hasn't this enviro test hassle kind of run its course? And as I checked into it, there were some good arguments for that in terms of the fact that newer cars, anyway, actually emit their emissions and their what they emit from burning gasoline actually is less than you know, rates that the testing actually tests for. Mm-hmm. And so the emissions and the pollution that comes from automotives that so what you have then is older cars really are the ones that emit the greatest amount of pollution, and it's negligible at best, you know. And what that means then is a lot of pollution, a lot of air pollution comes from stationary sources, power plants and manufacturing plants and things of that nature. And so, you know, and a lot of effort has taken place there in Weld County, for example. The oil and gas industry has spent literally millions of dollars to make sure that even the pollution sources from their equipment is minimal. Mm-hmm. And so it creates some, you know, some real issues for us. But if the EPA keeps kind of imposing unrealistic standards, it just becomes more problematic.
Yeah, well, the EPA has this idea, like, on going back to climate change or on ozone or on a lot of these issues, that they can unilaterally mandate, say, a cap and trade system. They've been looking at doing carbon emissions regulations, and I have an article here that talks about the U.S. House trying to put a stop to that. Not sure how much good that effort will do, but at least they're trying. Where you do have this top-down management that often comes from the EPA, which thinks, okay, we can stick our nose into state business for virtually any environmental problem that we see fit, that we need to go to the states and say, to heck with states' rights, to heck with the state regulatory systems, we're going to mandate something top-down from the federal government. Is that you're describing that in terms of ozone. Are there other areas where it comes in, where you really are fighting up against the federal interference when it comes to environmental issues in particular that way?
You know, I think there are several that come into play. You know, some of those are around, you know, pollution. Some of those involve water pollution, you know, for example. And so you have, you know, construction sites that have water, you know, runoff, and there's certain regulations. I haven't seen the bill yet, but, you know, for example, there was some, you know, concern about water quality coming off of construction sites that was basically going into, you know, to a river or to a drain system that eventually ended up in water treatment plants, mm-hmm. and then it would have required these water treatment plants to, you know, instill certain pieces of equipment to, you know, ensure that that various particles and contaminants were, you know, were not mm-hmm. in the water. And part of the problem, you know, Jimmy, is you get down to it, and these are so minute particles, it becomes kind of academic at most in terms of is it really making a difference? Is there really a health and safety issue here? And what's the bottom line we're trying to get to?
Well, it's sort of like what you were talking about with regard to climate change, and that is, even if we were to take it at face value that man is primarily responsible for climate change, if we were to eliminate altogether our carbon footprint in the United States, the impact on the growth of carbon emissions and the impact that that has on the climate, on the environment, is absolutely minuscule when you're up against India and China. So one of the things that I find when we're talking regulation at the state, or even more so at the federal level, is that you often have government making these decisions for private industry that put added costs on consumers as individuals and on those businesses as well, who, by the way, tend to pass those costs on to individuals, and that's disruptive to their ability to be productive as citizens and as enterprises, as the firms that comprise our nation's and our state's economy. But it's more problematic when the government gets in and says, okay, we're going to set this lofty goal, we're going to make these lofty regulations, and oh, by the way, your costs are just going to have to go up and you're just going to have to deal with it. What do you think?
You know, no, and as you, you know, share that trailer and that dilemma, what comes to my mind more than anything is government seems to be great at, you know, trying to address problems that create more problems that government addresses so that you create more problems. I mean, it, you know.
Well put.
Government is like, is the best at ensuring that it always has something to do because, you know, if there aren't problems that it, when government starts, you know, sticking its nose into various areas of, you know, of our life and business and our personal freedoms and so forth like that. It seems like one thing leads to something else, which leads to something else, which creates a law or a new regulation or a new enforcement mechanism.
And then it doesn't go away.
And it doesn't go away. Yeah. No, absolutely. It's job security, I guess, for government.
Yes. Well, Ronald Reagan had a phrase. I've often quoted it on this program. He said, the nearest thing to eternal life we'll ever see on Earth is a government program.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, as a final question before we go to a break with our guest, State Representative Ken Summers, at the federal level, you have massive expansions of government programs and so forth that stay in place. And also, of course, the federal government doesn't have the same kinds of budgetary restrictions that states like Colorado have. Do we see that problem take place a lot on the state level, or is it a less prominent?
You know, I think it's, you know, less prominent on the state level. But I find myself somewhat amazed even trying to understand the intricacies of government, government departments, quasi-government organizations, and how they all, you know, work together. It's, you know, as a legislator, you feel like you are constantly figuring out who does what and with who, and really where is duplication, where is complementary activity taking place. And, you know, we'll have a presentation to a committee, and you kind of think, I didn't realize we were doing that. I didn't realize this department existed or this function existed that either requires state resources or the involvement of the state department in some, you know, some form or fashion. And, you know, one of those, you know, for example, right now, when it comes to the issue of health care, you know, right now we have essentially two high-risk health care funding mechanisms, kind of safety net insurance programs. One is called Cover Colorado, which has been in existence for a number of years, and it's primarily for to provide insurance for those who are uninsurable because of the nature of their pre-existing medical conditions.
Right.
But with the introduction of you know, some legislation in Colorado, kind of in a sense, the Colorado Affordable Care Act and the federal Affordable, you know, Care Act, we have another kind of high-risk insurance pool called Getting Us Covered. And they're very close, very similar. Matter of fact, we have received, I think it looked up as something like $90 million for of funding for this program that is going to help provide coverage for those who need insurance coverage who are uninsurable. And you know, to be honest, I don't think it's even getting utilized that much because we have two programs that on the margins address the same population.
They could be consolidated.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. Well, when we come back with our guest, State Representative Ken Summers of House District 22, also the chair of the Health and Environment Committee, I do want to delve in a little bit more into health care. And then also we're going to talk about the situation going on in Wisconsin. I want to chime in on that with this whole debate over public sector unions and also get a little insight into how they operate here in the state of Colorado. Fitting in with our Southern Rock theme tonight, here's a little bit of some Blackfoot, the song Fly Away for you. Stay with us. Don't go anywhere. You are on Sang Center.
Wake up, baby. Smile at me. The sun is shining and the wind's blowing free. I got the that silver bird can take us away. Get it on there.
Live from Regis University, it's Sang Center with Jimmy Sangenberger, starring Miss Piggy. Watch it, Democrats! Hi-ya! Tony Soprano.
I'm going to make you an offer you can't refuse. Listen to the Sang Center podcast now on iTunes, or you're going to regret it.
The Pillsbury Doughboy.
Nothing says loving like a bun in the oven, unless it's Jimmy Sangenberger on The Real Deal, 93.9.
Kermit the Frog.
Hi-yo, everyone. It's not easy being green, especially now since that whole Al Gore thing.
And Austin Powers, KLCX Regis Radio, baby. Yeah, Pussycat, yeah. And now, here's your host, Jimmy Sangenberger.
And we're back here on Sang Center on KRCX 93.9, The Real Deal. Jimmy Sangenberger here with you tonight, bringing you Southern Rock and Politics here on KRCX. And we're back, of course, in studio with State Representative Ken Summers of House District 22, also the chair of the Health and Environment Committee in the House of Representatives here in the state. Representative Summers, it's good to have you on the program.
Hey, it's good to be with you, Jimmy.
Now, when we broke, we were talking about health care a little bit. And what I'm curious about is the extent to which we can expect the Obamacare legislation, starting now, but especially in 2014, to kind of hit against Colorado, for instance, with Medicaid eligibility expansions and with some other things that are required of the states, the exchanges and so forth. What insights can you give us into how that new federal law will impact state government here?
Yeah. You know, it's really going to have a significant impact, and we're already in the midst of implementing some expanded eligibility under state law that is related to Medicaid coverage. And that creates some real, you know, challenges for us. We have in Colorado and instituted a couple of years ago a bill that is referred to as the hospital provider fee, or some referred to it as the hospital bed tax. You know, somewhat, you know, certainly controversial from the political, you know, standpoint. It's basically provided the fact what happened is the hospitals went in and said, look, we'll To help with the expansion of Medicaid eligibility and to try to leverage some federal dollars, we'll put up a dollar per bed per day, and we'll kind of put it in this fund, and we'll draw down this federal match, and then we'll redistribute it to hospitals based on their Medicaid caseload. Mm-hmm. And so that problem, that bill is and has been in has been in place. It's been helpful to an extent in the fact that it has provided a higher reimbursement rate to hospitals for Medicaid patients and Medicaid populations. You know, from that standpoint, but as it increases eligibility, it doesn't necessarily fully fund all of the increased costs for that expanded eligibility for services outside of hospitalization. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is a significant issue that the Medicaid budget and increased eligibility for Medicaid is one of the most, if not the most significant issue that is driving state budgets. And it's because with the down economy, more people qualify for Medicaid. At the same time, as you're expanding eligibility for, you know, for Medicaid, it creates a very trying situation financially.
Mm-hmm. And just to clarify, Medicaid eligibility under Obamacare will go up to 133%. But that begins in 2014, right? Or has it already started?
You know, that begins in 2014. And also what it does in 2014 that is different now is it allows all individuals. Right now, individuals, adults qualify for Medicaid benefits if they have a child, basically, that qualifies. And in 2014, the expanded eligibility requirements, then all adults, regardless of family structure, would be able to qualify for Medicaid benefits.
And that's a good point. Now, the fiscal impact on Colorado, do we have any idea what that Medicaid eligibility impact will be here? I know in Florida and Texas it's going to hit hard, but then there are some states that it ends up, a handful that it ends up working out better for them just because of the amount that the federal government will still take on and that sort of thing. Do we have any idea yet on the fiscal impact?
You know, there have been some projections out there that have been made. I don't know all the numbers off the off the top of my head, but it is something that is under constant evaluation and analysis in terms of what that full impact is going to be. And our economists do have some, you know, projections on that. But it's very significant, and it's a big issue, especially when you know right now. And this is with the federal deficit. And when you look at the Affordable Care Act, the National Health Care Act, you know, it is just going to continue to, you know, cost, you know, more money to fund. It's going to cost businesses and individuals more. And, you know, it's very scary, especially in the fact that a lot of the regulations have not been defined. We're like playing this game, and we're playing the game while we're writing the rule book. That's kind of the situation that we find ourselves in. And so it's very problematic from that standpoint.
Yeah, that's an interesting analogy, playing the game while you're writing the rule book. I think that that's an accurate one, too, because that is exactly what's going on, is where the federal government is working on these sorts of things, and then you have to just play along as the things progress. The unfortunate fact of the matter is that whether you're talking about health care or other pieces of legislation, increasingly over the years, the federal government has been content to just tell states to do things. We can talk education. We were talking environment. We're talking health care. That they just expect that states somehow could magically pull out all the money, like rabbit out of the hat, and then go ahead and fund all of these unfunded mandates, all of these programs that the government pushes on them. But states like Colorado are already squeezed.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, so we constantly deal, and education is a good example of dealing with what is typically referred to as unfunded mandates. And it kind of, the states have unfunded mandates from the federal government. It seems like oftentimes, you know, the state pushes unfunded mandates down to school districts or to counties, you know, local governments, because of various laws that are, you know, that are passed. And it becomes a real challenge from that standpoint. And then, the converse of that is, as states then, as those mandates come down and there's looking for avenues by which to comply with these federal requirements, for example, in health care, then the states say, okay, how can we leverage federal dollars to help fund these programs? Mm-hmm. And, you know, once again, then we're going, they don't have the money. They don't really have the resources or their manufacturing resources. So we continue to get back into this cycle of just, you know, creating more federal debt.
Now, in Colorado, we're facing a rather striking budget shortfall. What's going on there in terms of the fiscal situation of this state? And then I want to tread over to Wisconsin in a moment. But as far as Colorado is concerned, what's our state of affairs here?
Yeah, you know, compared to some other states, I think one thing that is important for everybody to understand, what we're dealing with is, in this economy, in this historic time of recession, it's impacting the entire country, and in a lot of places, you know, far worse than Colorado. You know, we've heard of some of the challenges that California has had, for example. When we see the issues taking place in Wisconsin and other states, we realize that their budget deficit is multiplied compared to Colorado's. In Colorado, we're looking somewhere between maybe like a 1.2, 1.4, you know, billion-dollar shortfalls we plan for budget year 2011-2012. And that is, you know, obviously for us, with an overall state budget of around $19 billion, that is very significant for us. And so the challenges are great. The cuts are going to be significant. I would say by the time we have a budget adopted before this legislative session comes to an end, I think one thing you could say across the board is, everybody's going to be upset because everybody wants the budget balanced. They just don't want their program to suffer.
Exactly. Someone's ox is going to get gored no matter how you slice it.
Absolutely.
And we clearly see that over in Madison, Wisconsin. And the stuff going on there is just it just keeps getting crazier and crazier. I want to read a snippet from the Associated Press just a few hours ago. Wisconsin state troopers were dispatched Thursday to the doorsteps of some of the AWOL Democratic senators in hopes of finding at least one who would come back to allow a vote on a measure to curb the power of public employee unions. The stepped-up tactic ordered by the Republican head of the Senate came amid reports that at least a few of the missing senators were returning home at night before rejoining their colleagues in Illinois, where they're kind of trying to gather. Meanwhile, the state assembly appeared close to voting on the union rights bill after more than 2 days straight of filibustering. Democrats agreed before dawn Thursday to limit the remaining number of amendments they offer and the time they devote to each one. That could bring a vote later in the day on the measure Governor Scott Walker insists is necessary to ease the state's budget woes and avoid massive layoffs. We will strongly make our points, but understand you are limiting the voice of the public as you do this, said Democratic State Representative Mark Pocan of Madison, you can't dictate democracy. You are limiting the people's voice with this agreement this morning. And finally, it says, the marathon session in the assembly was grand political theater with exhausted lawmakers limping around the chamber, rubbing their eyes and yawning as Wednesday night dragged into Thursday. So before we get to kind of the substance here, we have in the state of Wisconsin right now 14 Democratic state senators who have left their post hightailed out of the state to avoid voting on this controversial piece of legislation. As a state legislator here in Colorado, Representative Summers, what's your reaction to that kind of action?
Yeah. When I've heard the news coming out of Wisconsin, not only from the action of elected officials, but some of the protests that are taking place. Yeah, I mean, to me, I've just been shocked at that type of action, taking place. First of all, elected officials and have a responsibility to attend to the business of the people. And you mentioned early part of that article made reference to state troopers. What people may not realize is as state representatives, as elected officials in the House and the Senate, we're obligated under law to be present and accounted for unless excused for a legitimate reason. And when that takes place, as is happening in Wisconsin, the state patrol is actually obligated to contact and compel the attendance of an elected representative in the House or a senator in the Senate in the Senate chambers. And so I think that's why some of the representatives have actually left the state. And in these trying times, it's important for elected officials to realize, hey, tough decisions need to be made. They need to honor the process. They need to, work together to address the issues forthright and to do it in a way that will, address the needs, recognizing that in these trying times, government cannot be in some protected bubble where they are immune from the realities of the economy, especially when government is funded by the activities of the economy.
Yeah. Oh, precisely. And, it's interesting to note that in Wisconsin, and this is what the debate is centering on more than anything, or at least part of the debate, rather, because there's a few different parts, components to it. But right now in the state of Wisconsin, public employees contribute less than 1% to their state pensions. And then for health care premiums, they pay 6%. For public or private sector employees, that's a lot more that you're going to pay. If you even have a pension plan for starters, but also if you have a health care plan, you're going to pay more for the most part than the amount that public sector employees are paying. What insight can you give us just initially as a comparison to Colorado? I know you're not an expert on union law and so forth, but to what extent do our public sector employees compare with those of Wisconsin?
Yeah. Right now, the public employees retirement account, the PERAs referred to, employees make a contribution of now it's between 10 and 12%. Actually, there was an increase because of legislation to try to create some financial solvency for PERA in this last session that created an additional, 2% reduction from employees' pay. And so, Colorado's in a drastically, different situation in terms of the contribution that employees make, that employers make. But it's still problematic in the fact that, we're not out of the woods. We have significant issues that for the long term that need to be addressed. We actually, Senate Bill 1 last year in the 2010 session, I believe certainly made some strides towards that, towards the goal of at least some initial stabilization, but it didn't address the long-term ramifications of a retirement system that, in the scope of things, is probably unsustainable. In mm-hmm. other words, and I made this statement to individuals, is that state employees need to realize that, your retirement, if you're hiring into the state, that your retirement program is not going to be the retirement program of mom and dad or grandma and grandpa. You know, we just can't be there. We can't afford a retirement system where you can retire at 55 or even you can retire at 60 and you make 80%. And if you retire later, maybe up to 100% of your highest average salary. I mean that's unfathomable when you think of when you compare of anything comparable in the private sector.
Well, the big conundrum that the state of Wisconsin faces is whereas we have about at best or at highest about a $1.5 billion deficit in Colorado. They have a shortfall of $3.7 billion in Wisconsin that they're going to grapple with. And by making these changes for pensions and the healthcare system there, contributions the public employees put forth for those two program areas, they would save $330 million. Now, of course, one of the problems that is still in play, the big issue where they have in this state, they've got, you know, they've got this issue where the public sector employees said, okay, we'll go ahead and we'll accept this change. We'll accept this change. But Governor Walker in the state still wants to move forward with trying to end public bargaining in the state, end collective bargaining in the state for public sector employees, which Colorado is one of the dozen or so states that doesn't have collective bargaining. And I don't know about you, but I think it seems to have worked fairly well for us, to at least to the best possible extent that we could get, given that we do provide other benefits and so forth, despite not having collective bargaining for our public sector employees. What do you think about collective bargaining for public employees and in Colorado as well?
Well, certainly I'm opposed to collective, you know, bargaining for public employees. You know, Colorado has had kind of this in terms of government employment, you know, situations, kind of a tenuous and delicate balance, but I think somewhat of an effective balance between with its state employees and. That was, you know, impacted in a sense when Governor Ritter, you know, signed into effect a ruling, his kind of, you know, midnight, you know, ruling on these employee partnerships that was very controversial. And one of the things that was supposed to have been a foundation stone of that is that it was presented as that, well, you know, state employees, they just want to allow departments want the latitude to establish these partnership agreements, and they want more say into how to help their department function more effectively, and they really don't want to. It's not motivated by, you know, fiscal concerns and things of that nature, and monetary concerns and payment structure. And one of the very first things, as soon as that was passed, within the first, you know, few months of it, was discussion on payment issues and pay increases and salaries and so forth like that. And, you know, to me, that just is not, a direction that we can afford to go.
Yeah. And I mean, there are no clamoring calls here in the state for us to go all out with terms of collective bargaining. But these kind of sidestepping ways that Governor Ritter pushed forth near the end of his term as governor, and then some other things that they've been trying to do show or demonstrate the need to be vigilant as citizens against that kind of change. But if you think about it with regards to collective bargaining, Representative Summers, one of the problems that can come from this is these guys are paid for by the taxpayers, paid for through the government, which is sort of an avenue for taxpayer money, determining where that's going to go. There's corruption that can come there when you have public sector employees that get taxpayer money negotiating for more taxpayer money. Absolutely. Through one plan or another. That promotes lobbying corruption and so forth that you don't get in private sector unions. It's very different.
Yeah. No, it really is. And I think it's important for individuals to realize that, you know, the different dynamic of government employment because of the – you know, the source of their funds and the fact that, you know, government employees are providing a service. They're running departments. They're there to serve the public. And you don't have some of the, you know, same issues that you do in the private sector. You know, for example, you know, I thought of it this summer when ran into, you know, an individual who was, you know, in a sense, you know, complaining about the fact that he as a government employee, he had not received, quote unquote, a raise since for 8 years or something. Well, he had received a pretty consistent cost of living increase,
right.
But he was complaining the fact that he hadn't received like a merit raise.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the issue, you know, with that is, you know, while we need to make sure employees are treated well, I think the statistics would prove that now public sector employees are not paid below private sectors, but they're equal or greater than many private sector employees. You know, the issue in the private sector, when you contribute to the growth of a business, you contribute directly to their bottom line.
Right.
And so a bonus or a merit pay, you know, recognizes that contribution that increases the bottom line. And
exactly.
That doesn't happen. You can't make that nexus in the public sector and in the government sector. And so the approach is different. Yeah, there should be, you know, some recognition of employees who do well and perform their jobs well. And I think they when the funds are available, there should be some avenue and way to recognize and reward that kind of contribution to. You know, to the system, but you can't draw a direct comparison from the private sector to the public sector on all these, you know, wage issues and, you know, all the employment type issues that come to play.
Our guest is State Representative Ken Summers of House District 22. Just a final comment for you to respond to before we wrap up here, Representative Summers. You know, one of the things that disturbs me when we're talking about budget issues in Colorado and Wisconsin, on the national level especially, in all these different areas, is how so many people think that they're not just entitled, but they also have a right to taxpayer proceeds, to proceeds from the taxpayers for whether it's outrageous union benefits or whether it's the right to do collective bargaining as a public sector employee, whether it's Social Security without having any type of reform. All these different types of things that people think, oh, you know what, the government has a right to give me what I am entitled to. You can't change it no matter what. I'm not going to accept it. And if you're going to try, then I'm going to kick and scream and throw temper tantrums until you get it my way or we reach some sort of quote-unquote compromise. It disturbs me the direction that we're going with what many have termed the entitlement society, where we now feel in America that when somebody earns money and they give it to the government, we are then entitled to it through something else. And that presents problems when we're trying to deal with fiscal issues, which for my generation are quite probably the most pressing issue that we are facing right now in the United States of America. And I think that it is really generational injustice, or as John McCain puts it, generational theft, for so many voters and politicians and unions and lobbyists and so forth to say, no, don't touch these sacred cows, these programs that we really want to keep intact. Just figure out some other way to deal with it, but you really can't do it. I think if we don't address this entitlement mentality, then we're just going to keep going down this path, whether it's in Colorado, Wisconsin, the U.S., or wherever. And it concerns me.
Well, it's a significant issue. And the more we increase benefits, the more that individuals and entities look to either the state or the federal government as the source of funding. We get our whole foundational principles of this economy, the economy that our country is based on, off balance. Mm-hmm. Is that, you know, government is supposed to provide the necessary support and structure for a vibrant and robust private sector economy.
Right.
As that economy grows, there are resources through income taxes, sales taxes, property taxes to support the critical functions of government. And the more that we become, you know, look to the government as the source of helping us or being there, you know, for us, the more problematic it can get. And one thing, Jimmy, that I think is important as we look at this challenging economy is that it's not realistic to say that we're going to go through the worst economy since the downturn in the economy since the Great Depression, and somehow government and government services are not going to be impacted.
Yep.
You know they are going to be. I think that, you know, to an extent they have been already, but we're going to really see it, you know, coming up. And unfortunately, that means some government employees are going to probably lose their jobs. But private sector employees have been losing their jobs. Private sector employees have been saying, you know what, we're all going to take a pay cut. We're all going to take a 5% pay cut, a 10% pay cut, so all of us can at least have some kind of income. We maintain our employment. Mm-hmm. And that kind of flexibility, unfortunately, isn't always exhibited and isn't exhibited as much in the government sector. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, you can think about it. And we have to make these tough cuts right now. And I just love it when you have people say, no, you know what? The kind of sacrifice that we need is for some people, maybe the rich, maybe everybody, to give a little more. No, we have to take a little bit away. It's a spending problem, not a revenue problem, and we have to really get real and start thinking about it and addressing those issues. State Representative Ken Summers, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
It's good to be here. Thank you for the opportunity.
We'll bring you back at some point. So when we come back here on Sank Center, we're going to bring on Kevin Miller. He is the author of the book Freedom Nationally, Virtue Locally. Stay with us. Don't go anywhere. You will certainly enjoy the conversation.